Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and fastest-growing segment of our society. To those of you who know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Today we're going to continue to cover the story of the just gross incompetence of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama. And in addition to that, we will, in our concluding hour, return to the presentation of Questioning Paul, so that we come to understand why Yahusha, which is the actual name of the individual Christians misname Jesus, was so opposed to him. Anytime over the next 3 hours, if you'd like to join in this discussion, you're encouraged to do so. Our number is toll-free, 877-300-7645. It was almost breathtaking in its irony. Over the last couple of days, the President of the United States, after bailing out of town in shame, I mean, there are people now who are calling for his impeachment on the grounds of gross incompetence based upon what he did in the Bo Bergdahl initiative with the Taliban. So he goes off to Europe, and while he's in Europe, he gives this grand speech saying that the United States, which is bankrupt, and bankrupt in large part because we spend $1 trillion a year. We squander $1 trillion a year between spying and the military, is going to spend $1 billion more in Eastern Europe. And that spending in Eastern Europe is going to be purely militarily spent, and that it's going to be directed at Russia. And in the same breath, this absolute ignoramus, this man who doesn't seem to have a neuron that is functioning in his brain, demeans the Russians and says the Russians are aggressive. And the world needs to stand up to Russian aggression. Meanwhile, the Russians have even removed their troops from near the Ukrainian border, even though their troops were in their country. And Obama is standing beside a new squadron of American fighters and a $1 billion commitment positioning the American military on the borders of Russia. Claiming the Russians to be condemned for being aggressive. And I didn't hear one media commentator say, wait a minute, aren't we being a bit hypocritical here? You know, and all the while, there is a story that we ought to be concerned about. There are individuals that we as a nation could play a role in freeing. Rather than seeking to free a man from captivity that sought to desert, sought to leave the U.S. military, who was having a grand old time, as we will find out, drinking tea, playing badminton, eating whatever he wished, we seem to do nothing. As Boko Haram, the most fundamentalist Islamic group on the planet today, continues to torture, murder, and rape the girls that they have kidnapped. Yes, even today, Boko Haram is back in the news. Here's just some excerpts of a story. It's from Kano, Nigeria, CNN. Scores of residents in four villages in northeastern Borno state of Nigeria near the border with Cameroon were murdered by Boko Haram raids. They claim that hundreds of homes were destroyed. Heavily armed gunmen dressed as soldiers in all-terrain vehicles and on motorcycles attacked Goshi. They attacked Nagapalwa. They attacked Anjanjara, all villages in the Gorza district, shooting at residents while burning their homes. The villagers fled to neighboring Cameroon to escape the onslaughts. My, oh my. And the locals are saying we're trying to compile a death toll. We really have no idea how many people were killed because we're afraid to go back to the village. And yet, there's no resources, no American resources out to find those over 200 little girls that are being tortured and raped by Boko Haram, by fundamentalist Muslims. No negotiations with Boko Haram, no. Don't seem to care about them. But you have an American deserter, and this president will engage the Taliban and exchange Taliban officers to get him back, all the while making Americans vastly more vulnerable because now you have affirmed that America will trade captives for captives. Great, huh? It is a just an absolutely despicable world that we have created. You know, to a large degree, it's our fault. Now, let's take a moment and let's consider the nature of those that Barack Hussein Obama thought were appropriate to give up for the American deserter. And by the way, I'm not trying to besmirch Bo Bergdahl's reputation by calling him a deserter. He was a deserter that he chose to desert. And matter of fact, I want the fact that he was a deserter known. I want what he wrote to his parents about American misadventures in Afghanistan being the motive for him deserting to be known. You know, if more people recognize that what we're doing in Afghanistan is counterproductive, that we made a bad situation worse, and if more people know that once you're in the military and you come to this realization that you can't get out, fewer people are going to be willing to join the military. More people are going to be willing outside of the military to question it. So I think it's good that he did what he did. I would agree with him, even though I'm no fan of Bo Bergdahl. But here's the people that were exchanged for him, in addition to the lives of six servicemen that were lost out trying to recapture him. The first of them is Karula Said Wali Karekwa. He's 47 years old. He was once the Taliban's interior minister. He helped create the Taliban movement in 1994. Now, that's not possible. I'm reading from CNN article. That's just not possible. You see, the Taliban came to exist well before the Carter administration. It was used by Jimmy Carter, Gates, and Zbigniew Brzezinski to fight a proxy war against the Russians. Khatta was not in power in 1994. This goes back to the late 1970s, and the Taliban had existed for a considerable time prior to then. You could not be a founder of the Taliban in 1994. Why is it that people write stuff that just absolutely isn't true? I had a person write me yesterday that says, you know, I read all your books and I really appreciate what you've done, but you make me want to scream. I'm so mad when you talk about 9/11 as being perpetrated by Muslims as suicide bombers flying planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And he said, you know, there's absolutely no trace of any airplane in the Pentagon. How do you explain that? You know, it's just like this journalist. You ought not believe, you ought not trust whatever source told you that there's no airplane debris in the debris field of the Pentagon. You just ought not believe them. You ought to find a more credible source. Same thing to this journalist. Whatever source told him that this fellow in 1994 was one of the founders of the Taliban, he ought to scratch that individual off and say, you know, that's probably not a source that I want to trust anymore. He was a hard hitter. He put that in fact, he put this in quotes. He was a hard hitter in his support for Taliban philosophy. Now, he's not quoting, I mean, he's quoting, you know, that's absolutely a quote. He's not citing the source of his information, that he was a hard hitter in support of Taliban philosophy. But he's attributing it to someone else because, you know, he doesn't know. And what he doesn't know is far more important here. The Taliban does not have a philosophy. That is correct. The Taliban does not have a philosophy. The Taliban is governed entirely by Muhammad's philosophy. Their entire constitution, their purpose in life, their every waking moment is guided by what Muhammad did and said. Full stop. They share that in common with every Islamic terrorist organization. These terrorist organizations do not have philosophies. There is no philosophy associated with Al-Qaeda. They are simply Muslims. They're adhering to what the Quran says and what Muhammad said and did as it's recorded in the Hadith. There is no Taliban philosophy. Mullah Muhammad Fazal was a senior commander in the Taliban army in the 1990s, rising to become its chief of staff. You know, it is funny. They're so desperate to apply westernized titles to these individuals, as if the Taliban has a chief of staff. You know, a chief of staff is what a military officer would have. It is what a politician would have. But the Taliban just don't have such titles. So Mullah Muhammad Fazi was a senior commander in the Taliban. He is, according to this journalist, he rose to become chief of staff. Yeah, I'm supposed to have a protocol officer, too. And then he writes this. He is thought by many to have supervised the killings of thousands of Shiites near Kabul in 1998 and in 2001. Well, 1998 and 2001. That's before the American invasion, right? We really don't know much about what happened in Afghanistan before the U.S. invasion. And how do you supervise killings? Okay, here I am. I'm going to play Nazi death camp supervisor here. I mean, come on. People participate. These are terrorists. They're Islamic terrorists. You know, they don't supervise killings. They may kill. They may come up with a plan that sends others out to kill. But it's like he was an office worker. He was performing a supervisory function. It's also clinical, you know. According to WikiLeaks documents, he was also present at the 2001 prison riot that killed CIA operative Johnny Spahn, the first U.S. citizen killed in the Afghan War. You know, he may have been there, may not have. Maybe that's why the CIA wanted him in captivity. But I've got a question for you. Why is a CIA operative classified as a civilian? Why aren't they counted amongst military deaths? I mean, if they're licensed to carry guns, trained to kill? What distinguishes them as civilian? And the number of people, look at Gates, who was head of the CIA, then went and be head of the Pentagon. It was a promotion, certainly. But this notion that he went from a civilian organization to a military organization is nonsense. It's just like you look at the NSA. The NSA is supposed to be a civilian spy agency. And yet the individual over it is always a 3 or 4 star general. It's a part of the mythos of the American government. Mullah Norullah Nouri, another of the detainees, was also present during Spahn's killing. And so what? I mean, really, so what? And he was a provincial governor. By the way, you know, at this point in time, when you're dealing with 2001, we're there in Afghanistan to kill the very Taliban that we had rented and equipped to go kill the Soviets. So at this point, we are belligerents. If Spahn killed a Taliban member based on orders from his government, George Bush at the time, or if the Taliban killed him, they were at that point enemy combatants. You know, if you don't want to be killed as an enemy combatant, you ought not go off into somebody else's country in opposition to them. You know, he was invading at that point Afghanistan. He was also suspected of involvement in the Shiite massacre. You know, think about this again. We had him incarcerated in Gitmo for a decade. And we don't know. The best we've got after all that time is he was suspected. Or if the government knows, is not telling us. I mean, are we to believe that the U.S. government decided that it would be appropriate to free three individuals who orchestrated the murder of 1,000 innocent people, and that we are so callous, so immoral, that we would release those who orchestrated the murder of 1,000 civilians to get one deserter back? Or did this have absolutely nothing to do with Bergdahl, and we thought that maybe if we started negotiating with those who were proud of murdering 1,000 civilians, that we could reach a really high-minded, moral, and just conclusion to the war. Continuing down the list of Taliban all-stars, next is Abdul Haq Wasik. He was 43 years old, which means he was went around 33 when he was captured. He was deputy chief of intelligence for the Taliban. You know, I think maybe the idea is if the U.S. military can provide journalists with these kinds of depictions, chief of staff and deputy chief of intelligence for the Taliban, if they can provide these kinds of perspectives on these individuals, that perhaps then it might actually look like the U.S. was really engaged in a war and we were fighting a real enemy because, you know, they have chiefs and deputy chiefs of staff and deputy chiefs of intelligence. I mean, come on. This is a religious organization. That's what it is. It's a religious organization. And because in Islam, religion and jihad are synonymous, they are terrorists. That's how, you know, you get a bunch of Pentecostals together, and what do? They rattle off nonsense, pretending to speak in some angelic language. That's what they do. You want to walk in, you want to hear a Pentecostal service, you know, That's what you're going to hear. That's what they do. If you go into an evangelical service, you're going to see people waving their hands up in the air. That's what they do. If you go to a religious service being conducted by the Taliban, they're going to be shooting their AK-47s. That's what they do. They're going to be going into villages and shooting everything that moves and torching homes. Because that's what they do. They don't have a deputy chief of intelligence. What do you think? If the Taliban has drones, the Taliban has satellites, that the Taliban has its own CIA, that they have an FBI, that they have a division of military intelligence? I mean, after all, you can't be intelligent and be a Muslim. It's impossible. The Quran is the worst book ever written. Muhammad was so stupid, it just hurts. He was no brighter than the black stone that he was speaking on behalf of. Come on, folks. You know, if you have to create a mythical enemy, perhaps you ought not be fighting. Well, this deputy chief of intelligence for the Taliban, according to his Guantanamo case file, he, quote, utilized his office to support al-Qaeda and was central to the Taliban's effort to form alliances with other Islamic fundamentalist groups, end quote. Now, why would you distinguish al-Qaeda from Islamic fundamentalist groups? And unless the person writing the case file for the Pentagon or the CIA has no idea that al-Qaeda is just one of gazillions of Islamic fundamentalist groups. And this I really need to know. If you're actually aware that al-Qaeda is an Islamic fundamentalist group, one of many Islamic fundamentalist groups, why are you unable to recognize that Islam is the problem? I mean, you can't be an Islamic fundamentalist and not be a good Muslim. An Islamic fundamentalist is somebody who, A, knows what Muhammad said, B, knows what Muhammad did, and C, follows what Muhammad said and did. So, if they are terrorists, it's because Muhammad was a terrorist. If they're rapists, it's because Muhammad was a rapist. If they're liars, it's because Muhammad was a liar. If they're mass murderers, it's because Muhammad was a mass murderer. That's what it means to be a fundamentalist. And indeed, Muhammad was all of those things, as are they. The moment you make the connection between fundamentalist Islamic and these terrorist organizations, then you're home. So long as you can process that information, it's one thing to write it, it's another thing to put it in quotes. But if you can process that information, the whole mystique of a war on terrorism is over. Your war is against fundamentalist Islam. Your war is against the words and deeds and example of Muhammad. And that's it. This is a case of journalists and the readers of this article having the truth put right before their nose, and yet they can't see it. At this point, there is no reason to mention al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is irrelevant if the groups are all fundamentalist Islamic groups. At that point, the only thing that is relevant is Islam. And what comprises Islam? Islam is comprised of two things, the Quran and the Sunnah. What is the Sunnah? The Sunnah is wholly comprised of Hadith. What are the Hadith? The Hadith are all reports from Muhammad and his companions. By the way, the Quran is Hadith. It is an oral report from Muhammad and his companions. Well, what does this Sunnah example comprised of hadith, oral reports from Muhammad and his companions, including the Quran, have to say? What does it tell Muslims to do? What would a fundamentalist Muslim do based upon the Quran and hadith, since they are fundamentalists? Well, the Quran orders Muslims to follow Muhammad's example. It orders Muslims to follow Muhammad's orders. Muhammad ordered them to be jihadists. Muhammad was a jihadist. Muhammad said, I have been made victorious with terror. Muslims are terrorists. Muhammad was a rapist. He was a kidnapper. He was a slave trader. He was a mass murderer. He was a ruthless terrorist. Therefore, fundamentalist Muslims following Muhammad's example are all of these things. The truth was right before the journalist's eyes. The truth is right before the readers of this article's eyes. And yet, none of them could process that information. He just went on and said his case file, like Kar Kawas, calls him a high risk, saying that he is likely to pose a threat to the U.S., its interests, and allies. He is a high risk. What makes him a high risk? Well, wait a minute. He was the liaison to fundamentalist Islamic groups. So that would mean that if you're the liaison to fundamentalist Islamic groups, that fundamentalist Islamic groups are a high threat to the U.S., to its interests, and to its allies. So here's a man who is a fundamentalist Muslim who the U.S. military has determined is a high risk, a high threat, poses a threat to the United States, to its interests, and to his allies, and we let him go. How in the world isn't the President of the United States impeached for doing that? He is now free to terrorize you and I. He is free to do as Muhammad did. He's free to engage in kidnap for ransom. Worked nicely for them with Bo Bergdahl, didn't it? He's free to do all those things. He's free to be a good Muslim, which is to be a liar, a mass murderer, a rapist, kidnapper, and worse. Muhammad Nabi Omari, 46 years old, was a member of a joint Al-Qaeda-Taliban cell in Eastern Coast. Okay, a joint Al-Qaeda-Taliban cell. You know, didn't know they had joint cells, did you? I mean, we are just so lost on all of this. They have a common denominator. Their common denominator is the Quran and Hadith. Their common denominator is Muhammad. The common denominator is Islam. That's it. They aren't joint operations. You know, it's not like the Haqqani network and the Taliban are different. You know, the United States wants to present them as different. This particular case proves that they're not, because all of the various Islamic fundamentalist groups in Afghanistan and in Pakistan passed Bo Bergdahl around between them as, you know, if he was a baton at a relay race. And it didn't matter which person you gave the baton to. Why? Because there is nothing that distinguishes one from another. They're all the same. According to his case file, and he was one of the most significant former Taliban leaders detained. I don't know why he wasn't given a fancy title then. At Guantanamo, he has ties to the Haqqani network, the group that was believed to be holding Bergdahl. Well, the fact of the matter is that the Haqqani network was only one of the Taliban allied groups. Maybe I'll call them an allied group, but that had him. He was all over the place. And so this distinction is meaningless. Karzai's office could not be reached for comment on Saturday, but it is likely that his administration will be disappointed that the prisoner swap wasn't attached to a broad reconciliation effort. But the fact was that it was. Well, that was the whole purpose of it. I mean, all you had to do, dear journalist, was to listen to the admissions out of the White House. The White House said this was part of a broader play to reengage the Taliban in reconciliation dialogue. That was the entire reason they did it. So why would Karzai's office be dismayed when that was exactly the reason that this took place? Lower-ranking Taliban commanders released from the Bagram prison by the Afghan government over the past year have already returned to the battlefield, according to U.S. officials, as has those Taliban officers that we previously released from Gitmo. They all gave pledges that, no, we won't do that anymore. We're not going to play jihad anymore. And they all went back immediately to playing jihad for their wannabe god, Allah. Why do we believe people who lie? What would the world be if we didn't have a quote from Senator John McClown, the Republican from Arizona? Quote, these particular individuals are hardened terrorists who have the blood of Americans and countless Afghans on their hands. Quoted Senator John McClown. You know, maybe he didn't get the memo. And he claims that he is, you know, every time somebody pokes fun at John, he says, you know, I'm sure you're well briefed and an expert on military matters, as if his time in a prisoner of war camp somehow made him an expert. I certainly didn't become an expert attending the Naval Academy, because if his father hadn't been an admiral, A, he would not have been admitted to the academy, and B, he would have been kicked out for ditching class. But nonetheless, John didn't read the memo from the Defense Department, which said that they were fundamentalist Muslims. They were fundamentalist Islamists. You know, John, that's why they act as they do. It has nothing to do with the tactic they deploy. Terror is just one of many tactics they deploy. And when they killed Americans, John, they weren't acting as terrorists. A terrorist ravages civilians. They were acting as Mujahideen, a militia engaged in armed conflict when they killed Americans. They aren't terrorists when they kill American soldiers, John. You ought to, you know, be familiar with the English language. After all, you're a senator. John, the fact is, yeah, they have Afghan blood on their hands too, but so do Americans. We've killed tens of thousands of them, John, and we were responsible for killing millions of them the last time we played this game in Afghanistan and used the Taliban. We didn't have any problem using the Taliban, John, during the Carter administration. We didn't call them terrorists during the Carter administration. Matter of fact, when Gates met with the Taliban, he spoke to them about the noble cause that they were performing in the name of Allah. And he spoke of their religious ambitions very favorably, John. It is it's a tragedy when those who send Americans off to die in war aren't willing to tell you the truth, that they want to create a imaginary foe. They want to cast a foe in a politicized propagandist image so as to make killing them heroic. And when they kill us, it's tragic. We invaded their country. They shot back. What did you expect, John? He went on to say, I am eager to learn what precise steps are being taken to ensure that these vicious and violent Taliban extremists never return to the fight against the United States and our partners or engage in any activities that can threaten the prospects for peace and security in Afghanistan. John, there is no way to threaten the prospects for peace or for prosperity or for security in Afghanistan. Because there are no prospects for peace and security in Afghanistan. You can't threaten that which doesn't exist. That would be like threatening the Easter Bunny. There is no Easter Bunny. You can't threaten the Easter Bunny. There is no hope for peace and security in Afghanistan. It wasn't before we invaded. There isn't now after we've invaded. We could stay there, John, for 1,000 years, which I'm sure you would like for us to do. We could send every able-bodied American into Afghanistan and give them all a gun. And we could not assure peace or security for Afghanistan. It's a lost cause, John, just like Vietnam. It was a lost cause before the first soldier set foot in the foreign land. You know, not another soldier needs to die for this lost cause. These individuals will make no meaningful contribution to the cause of Afghanistan. It's already lost. It never was real. It has always been a propagandist lie. We made a bad situation worse in Afghanistan. Worse in every conceivable way. The invasion of Afghanistan was morally bankrupt. It was asinine. It was suicidal on behalf of the United States. Let's finally, after so much death, recognize the truth, John.